A Changed Man by Thomas Hardy, narrated by Trevor O'Hare. Chapter 1. The person who, next to the actors themselves, chanced to know most of their story lived just below Topo Town, as the spot was called, in an old, substantially built house, distinguished among its neighbors by having an oriel window on the first floor, whence could be obtained a raking view of the High Street, west and east, the former including Laura's dwelling, the end of Town Avenue, hard by, in which were played the odd pranks hereafter to be mentioned, the Port Bredy Road rising westwards, and the turning that led to the cavalry barracks where the captain was quartered. Looking eastward, down the town, from the same favored gazebo, the long perspective of houses declined and dwindled till they merged in the highway across the moor. The white riband of road disappeared over Gray's Bridge, a quarter of a mile off, to plunge into innumerable rustic windings, shy shades, and solitary undulations uphill and down dale for 120 miles, till it exhibited itself at Hyde Park Corner as a smooth, bland surface in touch with a busy and fashionable world. To the barracks aforesaid had recently arrived the Hussars, a regiment new to the locality. Almost before any acquaintance with its members had been made by the townspeople, a report spread that they were a crack body of men, and had brought a splendid band. For some reason or other, the town had not been used as the headquarters of cavalry for many years, the various troops stationed there having consisted of casual detachments only, so that it was with a sense of honor that everybody, even the small furniture broker from whom the merry troopers hired tables and chairs, received the news of their crack quality. In those days, the Hussar regiment still wore, over their left shoulder, that attractive attachment, or frilled half-coat, hanging loosely behind like the wounded wing of a bird, which was called the police, though it was known among the troopers themselves as a sling jacket. It added amazingly to their picturesqueness in women's eyes, and indeed in the eyes of men also. The burgher who lived in the house with the oriel window sat during a great many hours of the day in that projection, for he was an invalid, and time hung heavily on his hands unless he maintained a constant interest in proceedings without. Not more than a week after the arrival of the Hussars, his ears were assailed by the shout of one schoolboy to another in the street below. "Have ye heard this about the Hussars? They're haunted." "Yes, a ghost troubles 'em. He has followed 'em about the world for years." A haunted regiment. That was a new idea for either invalid or stalwart. The listener in the oriel came to the conclusion that there were some lively characters among the Hussars. He made Captain Mombry's acquaintance in an informal matter at an afternoon tea, to which he went in a wheeled chair, one of the very rare outings that the state of his health permitted. Mombry showed himself to be a handsome man of 28 or 30, with an attractive hint of wickedness in his manner that was sure to make him adorable with good young women. The large, dark eyes that lit his pale face expressed this wickedness strongly, though such was the adaptability of their rays that one could think they might have expressed sadness or seriousness just as readily if he had had a mind for such. An old and deaf lady who was present asked Captain Mombry bluntly, "What's this we hear about you? They say your regiment is haunted." The captain's face assumed an aspect of grave, even sad, concern. "Yes," he replied, "it is too true." Some younger ladies smiled till they saw how serious he looked, when they looked serious likewise. "Really?" said the old lady. "Yes. We naturally don't wish to say much about it." "No, no, of course not. But how haunted?" "Well, the thing, as I'll call it, follows us. In country quarters or town, abroad or at home, it's just the same."
"How do you account for it?"
Mombry lowered his voice. "Some crime committed by certain of our regiment in the past years, we suppose."
"Dear me, how very horrid and singular!"
"But, as I said, we don't speak of it much."
"No, no."
When the Hussar was gone, a young lady, disclosing a long-suppressed interest, asked if the ghost had been seen by any of the town. The lawyer's son, who always had the latest borough news, said that, though it was seldom seen by anyone but the Hussars themselves, more than one townsman and woman had already set eyes on it, to his or her terror. The phantom mostly appeared very late at night, under the dense trees of the town avenue nearest the barracks.
It was about 10 feet high, its teeth chattered with a dry, naked sound, as if they were those of a skeleton, and its hip bones could be heard grating in their sockets. During the darkest weeks of winter, several timid persons were seriously frightened by the object answering to this cheerful description, and the police began to look into the matter, whereupon the appearances grew less frequent, and some of the boys of the regiment thankfully stated that they had not been so free from ghostly visitation for years as they had become since their arrival in Casterbridge. This playing at ghosts was the most innocent of the amusements indulged in by the choice young spirits who inhabited the lichened red brick building at the top of the town bearing WD and a broad arrow on its coins. Far more serious escapades, levities relating to love, wine, cards, betting, were talked of, with no doubt more or less of exaggeration. That the hussars, Captain Mombry included, were the cause of bitter tears to several young women of the town and country is unquestionably true, despite the fact the gaieties of the young men wore a more staring color in this old-fashioned place than they would have done in a large and modern city.